Today on Wings, a South Asian multimedia artist achieving international recognition for her socially conscious works.
I think kind of boredom sets in, and people want to fill that void. That void can well be filled by aggression. We have to revive imagination.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
My name is Nalini Malani. I'm a narrative artist. I tell stories. I'm not a Hindu, but I'm attracted to the myths because for me it's the language. To link with people, there are so many characters that give you complex psychological stories which have come down to us through the ages, where there are universal truths.
Artist Nalini Malani, during a major exhibition of her work, Transgressions, at the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam in the spring of 2017.
Nalini Malani is een hele beroemde kunstenaar uit India. Ze maakt kunstenaarsboeken, muurtekeningen, zijn performances, daar is videokunst.
Now as we enter the room, on the left side is an ephemeral wall drawing which spans about 3 meters by 7 meters. You have a denuded man holding the globe, which is half broken. The people you see, the two large faces with staring eyes and the little girl, they all come from a world which is extremely deprived. It is the world of the dispossessed.
Malani was born in Karachi in 1946, becoming a refugee during the partition of India when Pakistan became a separate country. She works across a variety of media, including painting, video, drawing, and installations. She has earned international acclaim through her creation of installed works known as shadow plays. These shadow plays combine classical icons and myths from both East and West, painted on large rotating mylar cylinders that the visitor walks among and between, becoming part of the shadows cast, while hearing poems or classic texts, which often revolve around those suppressed and silenced, refugees, the poor, and women and children.
Vegetarian or non, what turns you on?
In this work, the job, I for the first time made cylinders. The theater which we were going to work in had very high ceilings, and from the flies I had the cylinders coming down, and the costumes would change and the scenario would change only through the cylinders. And I made 5 such, but as these cylinders came down, they twirled and formed shadows because I'd painted on them. And we couldn't travel with this play, and it was very difficult to pay the actors, and it was altogether difficult to perform in India. I decided to make video shadow plays.
That was the artist Nalini Malani during her exhibition at the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam in spring 2017. Her installed works, In Search of Vanished Blood and Transgressions, are both in the permanent collection of the Stedelijk Museum. I asked Malani how it was being a woman artist in the 1960s in Bombay.
When I had this show in 1966, I was given a pat on the back by a man who was about 50 years old, and he said, "Oh, very good work, but now it's about time you got married and fitted your role as a woman." Now, in the art scene, up to a point, there was a kind of a patronizing attitude by male artists. And if you really started to do well, there was a hell of a lot of criticism. So it was really an uphill task. And it is the same even till today. So this is kind of a strange, passive-aggressive kind of attitude that many of the male artists would have towards female artists. And it was in 1985 that I wanted very much to have a women's art exhibition, and I counted about 50 artists from all over India. We got no funding at all, so finally it got pared down to 4 artists, and we traveled the whole country with our kids on our hips, showing in open spaces and in alternative spaces, etc. And that set the ball rolling, and I think a number of the younger artists have really taken that on and felt a little more empowered.
Do you feel like you've broken down barriers now?
There are barriers, but I think the younger women are doing extremely well for themselves, and you really see excellent work coming out. So I think it is really due to their own characters that they've been able to forge ahead. Women are very empowered, and they're really speaking about these things very much more openly than we could at that time in the 80s.
One of Milani's earliest shadow plays, In Search of Vanished Blood, was sparked by the violent mass sectarian riots in Bombay in 1992 and 93. In this shadow play, she used Hindu myths combined with revolutionary poems to explore the violence and loss of life. She wants to create dialogue around violence, including rape.
Well, in India, we are really going through a retrograde situation, and we have a kind of epidemic against women. Male chauvinism, patriarchy has increased in a huge way. There's a rape a minute. So it's not only artists. We have to work together to find ways to change the scenario in so many ways.
Systemic, endemic, enduring, ongoing violence against women it's a pandemic. It's everywhere. This is a recurring theme in your work.
Yeah.
Why was this the theme that you have chosen to interweave into almost everything you've done?
Well, there are many things that go into this, of course. The one thing I would resent as a younger artist was when I was asked, do you paint from the woman's point of view? So I said, look at me. What do I look like? Am I a woman? So the person says, yes. Well, I paint from that point of view. It is a given, just as much as I wouldn't ask you, a man, do you paint from the male point of view? And if you did paint from the woman's point of view, I'd say, chapeau, you've made it. But you don't. So I have to continue till that moment comes when I see in your work the problems that we face. And so this is a kind of a battle that keeps going on. But I think that there is a female psyche that operates independently, I think, from gender, from male and female persons. And the masculine and the feminine thought processes are in all of us. And it's that balance that's most important. On a very popular level, you hear things like, but look at Margaret Thatcher, or how Mrs. Indira Gandhi was towards late in her life. She became really very aggressive. And so how do you understand that? And I get this a lot from feminist philosophers. And then you come to the point of view that the female principle and the male principle, the masculine principle, doesn't belong to either the man or the woman. It is this balance which is of acute importance. And we work from both. It depends on which is operative at that time. And I find this a very, very useful idea to work with, because I can even see it in myself. Which part am I working from at that moment?
Where I'm trying to understand is how that relates to this theme of violence and suppression that seems to follow through in most of the works that I've seen.
Well, I always have an area of hope. It's not so desolate, it's not so dismal that you will not see an area of hope. That you do see. Because it's not only the female that I am speaking about, it's also the workers, it's also the people. I mean, 60% of the people who live in Bombay are below the poverty line. They live in slums. They don't have water. They don't have electricity. And there's much that I've done in that area too. So it's the dispossessed. And amongst those dispossessed, the worst off are the women and the children.
Are you looking at this from a global perspective or from a local perspective?
I am looking at it more from a global perspective because it really has to do with the post-colonial world. And the wall drawing that I have done has to do with a large part of humanity who lives outside of the American-European setup. They are the ones who are really being counted like numbers. That's where the statistics come in. We all have a number. And this is the problematic. As long as the world is not seen as one whole, as one planet, where each affects the other, if something is happening in Japan, it's going to affect Alaska. And this we've seen. And that connects to ecology. We have to see things as a whole. That's the only way we can preserve this beautiful planet. And I think it has to do with how you treat people, because humans are part of that.
Do you think that things have just gotten very much worse in the last few years?
Well, the thing is that one has gotten to know a lot because of the internet, which is great. And I think greed has overtaken. You know, as Gandhi once said, and it's very important what he said, we have enough to feed mankind, but we do not have enough for mankind's greed. So greed is an enormous cavernous mouth which is consuming and consuming to such an extent that it's walloping the rivers, it's walloping all the jungles, and you know, there's this mining is creating hell in India and many parts of the world where jungles are just disappearing completely. And then the governments say, oh, it's getting warmer and warmer. We are having sandstorms and whatnot in the deserts. And there was this terrible storm in New York. So why is all this happening? I use a lot of myths, and Cassandra is one such. And you know the Cassandra myth, the prophecy. She could hear the future. We all can. We all know it. We're speaking about it now. But why aren't we doing anything? It's all going downhill. Fukushima, look at the disaster.
Do you think that we're looking at a new, more insidious form of colonialism going on? In terms of where the wealth is going, it creates a workers' class of people that are not able to survive through their work and through their labor.
Maybe colonialism may not be the word because that's an old word, but a class of people who are getting more and more wealthy and want to keep that wealth and want to grow their wealth even more is in the whole world. It exists in India in a big way. There are a huge amount of billionaires in Asia, India being one. Those are connected. If there's a Goldman Sachs in New York, we have that in India too, and we have that in China too. So that's the class that's coming up. It has nothing more anymore to do with governments, and it doesn't have anything to do with nations. It's this class that is hovering over us, that is slowly, slowly sucking out the very lifeblood of the earth.
Okay, so now we come full circle back. So what do you believe art can do about that?
The thing is that art, as in the visual arts, can showcase the problem, can speak about it, can argue about it, can bring it forth, can make people aware. We don't have answers. We have a few answers which we read about, etc. But the very fact that the problem can unfold through an artwork, that is already doing a lot.
And what do you think that it does? Do you think it's a form of education, or do you think it's a form of dialogue?
More dialogue. I really feel seriously that art has a three-bodied relationship. It's the artist, the artwork, and the person viewing it. Three of us together make the artwork wake up. And that's the only way the art becomes dynamic.
What sort of dialogue are you hoping these works, these collections, because there is a wall painting, there is a large work of cylinders, painted cylinders, that are projected like shadow plays, yes, called transgressions. Yes. There are videos, there are paintings, there are books that you have hand-painted. What does the work collectively, what sort of dialogue do you hope it creates?
I want to seduce. I want the people to come in and get seduced. That's the first level. But having gotten attracted to the lights and the flickerings and so on, I want people to look at what is happening. And there should be an area, a space for thought. That's what I'm looking for.
What is it you're trying to start a dialogue on with the work Transgressions?
Well, Transgressions was made in 2001. The show was called Unpacking Europe. And I do respect very much the curator, Salah Hassan, who teaches in the art history department at Cornell. And we were artists from parts of Africa, parts of India, China, Australia. And what was happening at the time in India was the beginning of globalization. So far, we had aligned ourselves to the Eastern Bloc up to 89, the Soviet Union, etc. But bit by bit, that was changing. And it was a moment where India didn't quite know exactly which way to turn. But then we had a prime minister who was a Harvard graduate, and so he turned towards capitalism in a huge way. And a country which only had two soaps and two shampoos and two cars to choose from suddenly had this range of consumer items in the shops. And so it's a kind of, if you listen to the poem that was made, it talks about the cell phone coming in, the cell phone company Orange, and how they're trying to sell their product by saying that you can make a telephone call for less than the cheapest food you find in the streets. So these were the billboards, actually. And this was addressed to workers. So who were they trying to capture? The very poorest. And this is how they caught hold of people and were trying to sell their products. So there's a number of products there that are spoken about in this crazy poem. And then there's a girl's voice, a little girl's voice who says, and I wanted to go to an English school. And Mama, was no fool. She sent me to an English school because it would mean I would get a job afterwards. So you feel a kind of frisson, you know, when you hear it. That what does this lead to? You're going to lose your culture? Because I have a whole lot of languages from India going into the earth like rain. Because who's going to learn those languages? They are very rich languages with their own culture, their own literature, their own music. But soon that's all going to go. Because the dominant language and the functional language is English.
It was the best, the best, the best of times. We had everything, everything, everything before us. We were all going direct, direct, direct to heaven. Vada pav, rupees 3. Airtime, rupees 149. Nimbu pani, rupees 3. Airtime, rupees 149. Hello, can you hear me? Of course you can hear me. I speak orange, I speak blue. I speak your speak just like you. Let me ask you a question. How many square feet of land would the Japanese get in Tokyo with what they spent on that golf course in Goa? In Goa. Goa. Goa.
And Amma, please send me to English school. And Amma, she really was no fool.
You are listening to Wings with me, Mindy Ran, in conversation with artist Nalini Milani. The nonsense poem you have just heard is part of a shadow play installation called Transgressions. In this work, video projectors show Caucasian skin, while painted cylinders cast moving shadows, including segments of Bollywood movies, disappearing languages, a Western hunter on an elephant, a female deity, two boxers representing Pakistan and India, all while the nonsense poem rings in your ears.
So, so, so la ti do, so la ti do. I do in high heel shoe. I do want to be like you. I orange, I blue, I do.
We only have 24 hours in the day, and half that time we're sleeping. So the rest of the time, there's so little that you can really do to conserve. You know, you're busy making enough money to be able to put your family together, etc., etc. So there is a lot of culture that we are losing. There's no doubt about it. But then there's a fear. And I think a lot of what's happening today is this fear. So there's a kind of phobia that's coming in, and therefore this global, local thing, where the local now is trying to conserve, but it's becoming extremely orthodox. And orthodoxy is setting in out of a kind of fear. This is what I noticed in India. And I think it's happening to some extent in the United States as well, and especially in the poorer communities, where they feel threatened, there's a threat, that certain values are going away, and whatever those values may be. For example, religion. Religion has taken a back seat in the big cities in the United States. But in the Midwest, I think a lot of that is coming back. And therefore, I think the current president has had such a lot of appeal.
Do you think the fear that you're talking about is different or manifests differently in each country?
Yes, of course, because it really depends on the different cultures and the communities and so on, yes.
So what is the fear in India?
Well, in India it's a bit complicated. In 1947 the country was divided. To a large extent I think this was what the British did, and as they did also in Palestine. And this led to a bloodbath. The idea was that Pakistan would have the Muslim communities, whoever wanted to go there, and everybody else who wanted to stay back in India were welcome to do so. And this was a secular country. India is a secular country. It's in the constitution as well. But now, because religion has come in such a big way, that people are forming groups, and in Hinduism, there is, apart from the religion, there's a caste hierarchy. So the caste is taking over in a huge way. The upper castes are, you know, sort of reinforcing themselves, and politics is going by caste.
But this is a resurgence then.
Well, it was sort of always sort of simmering under the surface, and politicians use caste for their votings, in the polls, you see. This is a problem. And what happens then, the people who suffer the most are the ones from the lowest caste. They're treated the worst. They're like the First Nation people. There has to be a space for thought. When the imagination is dulled down, or dimmed down because of all the other factors, people cannot live a life internally. And I think kind of boredom sets in, and people want to fill that void. That void can well be filled by aggression, because that dilutes boredom. I think there's some crazy things are happening in the psyche of people's minds, where these holes are taking place, and these holes get filled up with a lot of hatred, because there is no imagination. We have to revive imagination. That is what is important, I think.
You've made it clear in several different ways that regardless of what's happening where, it's the women and the kids that get it the worst, which, I mean, could be said of any situation anywhere that's terrible, that you look at refugees, that you look at starvation, right. It's always the women and the kids.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. I had a residency in Provincetown, beautiful place, and this is February, it was cold. They had a local radio station, and all I had in my studio was a radio. And I hear this cry on the radio, and there's this desperate woman saying, look, I'm on the beach. I'm living inside a tent. My husband's thrown me out with my two kids. I'm in a dreadful situation. My children hate it because the bus has to come and pick them up from the tent. And I have no phone. I have to go to a public phone to make calls. And then I have to sit over there because in case I get a job, I have to wait for this call to come through. How to do that, you see? And she said, I'm treated like a criminal by the police. I have no home. I'm thrown out. And this is Provincetown. This is where the richest people come to holiday. Massachusetts. I was shocked. This was 1989. I was shocked. Really, I was shocked.
Did she get any help?
People helped her. But the fact that she was there, out on the beach, it was bloody cold. And two little children. And I said to myself, this could happen in India. This is happening in one of the richest states of the United States.
What's happening globally at the moment is happening to so many different people and so many different groups. But as we just said, it's women and children at the bottom. And I think that when we start to look at it, the barriers of borders and imaginary walls, walls yet to be built, they're disappearing in that people are beginning to understand, as you just said, that could have happened in India, but it was happening in Massachusetts. Do you feel that this is true, that there's this layer underneath of people that are starting to recognize it's not only us, it's overall?
Well, I hope they are, because I think that is a way that where people can think together. That's why people, women's marches and people coming together, etc., is important. But people coming together with one voice will make a difference.
You have faith in numbers.
Well, I think that it's been proven that you can reverse things. You can change the laws in certain countries just by being there in numbers.
That was the artist Nalini Milani during her exhibition at the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam in spring 2017. Our thanks to Milani and the Stedelijk Museum for use of the sound clips from the artwork Transgressions. In Search of Vanished Blood and Transgressions are both in the permanent collection of the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam. This is Mindy Ran for Wings in Amsterdam.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. And please visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including your community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.